World Cup is in its month-long run in Qatar. The U.S. qualified after missing out in 2018. It's the only time the U.S. did not qualify for the World Cup since 1990, when they ended a 40-year absence. That's right, the USA was not in the World Cup between 1950 and 1990. This is a tale of that 1990 quest.
And welcome to SportsCenter. I'm Bob Lee. Minutes from now, prime time with all the National Football League news. We've got football news. We call it soccer. The rest of the world calls it football. And the entire world was watching today as the USA visited Port of Spain, Trinidad, to contest the last spot in the field of 24 for the 1990 World Cup in Italy. It was quite simply the most important soccer match the U.S. has played for the last two generations. A win, and only a win, would put the national team into the elite field for next year's World Cup. It was a packed field and a packed stadium in Trinidad and Tobago. Thousands of fans, 30,000 on hand, an entire nation wearing the national colors of scarlet. There weren't many U.S. fans there, but those that were in attendance were delirious.
Fans are here to witness what has to be the most important game in the history of the United States Soccer Federation. The USA national team must beat Trinidad and Tobago in order to advance to the World Cup in 1990. A tie or a loss will do them no good, and then Trinidad, in fact, would advance to the World Cup for the first time in their history. Clearly, this is the most important 90 minutes in the history of the players on the U.S. national team.
Author Adam Elder, in his new book, New Kids in the World Cup, writes that this is the team that changed American soccer forever.
The funnest part with any writing is, it's like when you find a story that you really like, it's like a dog with a bone. You just want to keep chewing on it like all day long. You know, I would joke to my wife that, you know, I was like physically there when I was writing the book, but like in my mind was like back in 1989 and 1990, you know.
This is Adam Elder's first book.
It was a lot easier, I think, than magazine writing. The editing was a little less intense, and I was just kind of left to my own devices a little more. But it's one of those things where, you know, you finish writing it, but that's where things sort of just get started. Then you got to figure out a title, figure out the cover image, you know, get the photos, and then, you know, of course, there's copy editing, the fact checking, and all that sort of stuff. So, yeah. And then the marketing, which is exhausting, marketing a book. But when it's something, and I just love the story and I never get tired of talking about it. So, you know, a lot of people told me you'll get sick of talking about the book, but I never will. I just love the story and I love this team.
The author of this book joins us next to talk about the story that's three decades old and finally it's been told. His name is Adam Elder. I'm John Schrader, and this is Watch the Media. The title of the book is The New Kids in the World Cup. Long title, stick with me. The subtitle, The Totally Late 80s and Early 90s Tale of the Team That Changed American Soccer Forever. And the author of that book is with us now, Adam Elder. And thanks so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Yeah, fun to be on. Looking forward to talking.
So I want to talk more deeply about the book. I want to talk about you as well, but the title is a bit audacious. Is this indeed the team that changed American soccer forever? And was that the premise before you started, or the premise you learned after you got into it?
That was definitely the premise I learned after I got into it. I didn't know much about this team to start off with. The process started with, you're a longtime soccer guy. I'm sure you've seen this music video that the 1990 team made, a rap video. They're dancing on the beach, they're rapping with OJ Simpson and American Gladiators and retired football players and so on and so forth. This whole book started with that crazy video, which itself was made as sort of this like desperate plea for attention to a nation who is, you know, very indifferent to soccer, to be very polite.
USA has realized a dream. They will qualify for the World Cup in 1990.
Togetherness and unity means victory for you and me, with dedication, heart and soul. You have the tools to achieve your goals in a battle. I never lose because I'm a champion. I march on till victory is won. Reaching higher, striving harder, always doing better because it's a part of the winning spirit. You got to keep your chin up and we'll be coming home with the World Cup. So put your best foot forward. Together, let's step. But make sure momentum is kept. Togetherness and unity means victory for you and me. With intellect and self-respect, attain whatever you want to get. Togetherness and unity means victory in Italy. With dedication, heart and soul, you have the tools to achieve your goals.
When I was young, my folks would demand, work hard for what you want and be the best you can. Stay out of trouble, get an education. If you do, you gain admiration. Respect yourself as well as others. Love your sisters and love your brothers. Stay off drugs, keep your mind clear so you can see when victory is near. Togetherness.
The reason I mentioned that music video is because I originally did a story about the making of that music video. And it led me to talking to all these players on the team. And it was a team that I didn't know much about. I knew they were the first team to make the World Cup. And obviously that's very important. But I didn't know their story until I started talking with them, not just about the music video, but about their whole story. And I realized what an incredible story this is. It's kind of like the origin story of modern American soccer. And most people don't know it. And so I like to say that that crazy music video they made in order to get attention, you know, is so many decades later led to me actually writing a book about it in a very roundabout sort of way. But to answer the first part of your question, I think they did change American soccer forever, because if they hadn't done what they did, first of all, the players believed that there would be no more soccer for them if they didn't qualify for the World Cup. And so did several figures around soccer. I mean, there were a lot of moving parts because, you know, the United States had been awarded the hosting duties for the 1994 World Cup. So that was sort of in place. But, you know, when everything's conditional when it comes to how an organization like FIFA operates. So it's quite possible that there would have been no World Cup if this team had not done what they did. And by making history, by ensuring that there was more soccer for them to play in this country, I would certainly argue that they changed soccer forever.
So you have written about soccer before, but not fully, right? You were not a 100% soccer journalist. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. I would usually do feature stories about it. I did a lot of sports. I work for sports magazines and things like that. But I was never a beat writer. Mm-hmm.
So, so you just came up with this idea. You saw this video and said, "I need to know more about this video," and that's where it happened. Or did you get assigned that? How did that happen?
It was a story I freelanced during the 2014 World Cup for the New Yorker's website. I had come across this video just the way that people come across videos on YouTube. And, you know, I rolled my eyes at it and cracked up at it. And I just thought it'd be like this kind of quirky story to do. And it didn't turn out. I mean, what I had sort of intended at the time is it was about the making of the video, but it was also kind of about the making of modern American soccer in a way. And that's eventually what you could say the book turned into.
How long did you work on this book?
Oh gosh, I worked on the book off and on for probably 5 years. But you know, that involves like picking it up and putting it down. And you know, the book was all ready to go right before the 2018 World Cup, and then the United States forgot to qualify for it.
Yeah.
And so interest
that's the team
from
that put soccer back.
Yes,
the team
exactly.
That put them ahead. That's the team that put them back.
Yes, exactly. So the interest from publishers dried up, and I sort of had to start from scratch almost. I tinkered with the proposal. Wrote a couple more sample chapters. I got myself an agent, things like that. And Next go around, it was right around the time where COVID hit. That was just for timeline purposes. That's when I started pitching it around and started getting some interest in it.
So, but the core of the book, the most of the book had been written before 2018. It had been ready to go.
Oh no! I should be more specific. No, I hadn't written anything. I think I wrote like two or three sample chapters. Uh-huh. And I kept, I would say, very little of them in the final edition. It was after I got a publisher that I started talking to a lot more players, and not just players, but you know how it goes with journalism. Mm-hmm. They refer you to someone else and you think, well, what use is that person going to be? And then they turn out to be like the greatest source ever. You get all the great stories from them. So it's, you know, that sort of hopscotching path that you take from one source to the other to put a story together. So this all came together in the last couple of years. And honestly, I put it together very quickly over the summer and fall of 2021. I was kind of facing a deadline and behind on a deadline. And a lot of other stuff was going on in my life. One of my parents passed away, and I just freelance gigs were very uncertain at the time. And I just, honestly, I put everything I had into this book, and it kind of like helped keep my head on straight in a way, I feel like.
When you write a book, Adam, you have to make sure that you've got some characters. It's a nonfiction book, but there have to be some characters that are the core of the story. Who are the, you know, for those who haven't read it, you know, give too much away, but who's the core of this story?
The core of the story? Yeah, no, you make, first of all, you make an interesting point. With a team, you're always dealing with, you know, sort of an ensemble cast. But there's always a few, you know, leaders and just characters within a team that stick out. I'd say, first of all, is the head coach, Bob Gansler, this sort of stern, old school Midwesterner, sort of classically German, Germanic coach. And then there's also this like trio of guys from New Jersey who are well known to American soccer fans, who are Tab Ramos, John Harkes, and Tony Miola. And beyond that, there's this amazing larger than life personality. He started out in the book as the US number one goalkeeper, David Benoli, this sort of gregarious Southern Californian from Manhattan Beach who looked nothing like an elite athlete, but was one of those people who was an elite athlete in like every sort of way. He could play any sport. He could dominate any sport. He just so happened to choose soccer and was this incredible goalkeeper with very quick reflexes and, you know, kind of almost like the mascot of the team. You know, he would lead the team in sing-alongs, and he would lead them out on nights of the town. He was the classic locker room guy. He was just kind of like the lifeblood of the team. And then as the team sort of progresses, you get these youngsters coming into the team and sort of upsetting the apple cart. And one of whom is an American soccer legend by now, Eric Winalda. But when this book when this book takes place, he was 20 years old and just breaking into the national team.
In one of the early scenes you take us to is a scene that Paul Caligari wanders into, this sort of Hollywood music thing. And I know what you're doing, because I know how Paul Caligari plays into this story, but that was really crafty storytelling to introduce us to, foreshadowing for us, somebody who's going to make a real difference in this story, somebody who's going to be a character that we don't forget in this story. But tell us a little bit about, there's two things that intrigue me about that. The relationship between and how this worked, and some of the other people that we'll learn more about as we go on, some of these sort of famous people. But you're recreating a scene in a place, in a time that you weren't at. So part of me is thinking, as the writer, I want to know how you do that. And the other part is the crafting part of it, to put that scene where you did in the book. Does that make sense to you? It's a two-part question, sort of. But let's talk about why put that scene in the book where you did and what it meant.
Right. That's a great question. I think part of it had to do with, as I said, you know, I started learning about this story through this music video that they made that I keep going back to. And this is how that music video got made. Paul sort of sneaks into almost this party for George Michael in the Hollywood Hills by this star producer named Michael Lippman, who's one of these sort of Los Angeles star makers. And, you know, once inside this party, he's hobnobbing with basically a who's who of MTV in the day. And what I wanted to do there most, I mean, sort of the subtext throughout this book is how uncool and unpopular soccer was in America at the time. And soccer's sort of tortured relationship with popularity, mm-hmm. with being a sport that is considered un-American. And so I thought it was just so cool that Paul finds himself at this party where with America's most famous people. And in any other country in the world, Paul, a professional soccer player, would be the one that everyone is fawning over. But Paul's a nobody at this party. And I just thought it illustrated, like I said, America's sort of relationship with soccer. It juxtaposed it so nicely, the glitz and glamour and the power that America's entertainment industry has throughout the entire world. And here's this, you know, soccer player in the middle of it at a very dark time for American soccer.
You have to recreate this scene. And I know right. you interviewed a whole lot of people for this story. So how do you as an artist, as an author, as a crafter of this tale, recreate this scene for us so vividly?
Yeah. I bugged Paul Caligiuri a lot about this. I think he got sick of me asking so many questions about this party that happened several decades ago. I actually drove up to a game he was coaching in Orange County. I live in San Diego. I drove up to Orange County and just stuck around and waited and just to talk to him for like 20 more minutes about okay, where'd you go after this? Who'd you talk to in the kitchen? And what did Salt and Pepper say to you? And then, you know, you saw Tom Petty. What did Tom Petty say to you? I mean, I just tried to get every last little detail out of it, mm-hmm. Including the fact that, you know, he was injured and he was hobbling around, which is, you know, kind of funny for a professional athlete to be like hobbling around at this party. But anyway, it was just some dogged reporting, I guess, nothing more than that. And also, I mean, I think there's a part of it too that as a writer, when you find a story fascinating, you really want to get every last piece. And I get what I was trying to say a moment ago, I guess, when a writer finds a story fascinating, it's easy to sort of like piece it together in your head. And I just thought it was such a cool scene to not really open the book with, but to sort of like, I don't know. It was like a nice act one digression, I guess.
Do you think, Adam, that young people in America now who have, our young students here are fascinated with European soccer? They know who all the great players are in the world, right? They understand that U.S. is, despite, as we record this, despite their failures in the first knockout round of this World Cup, at least they played in this World Cup for the first time in 8 years. But they know all of these things. Do you think people are surprised that the place of soccer was only three decades ago? It was 1990. Much of this happens in 1989 as you qualify, as you recount the qualification for the World Cup that was played in Italy in 1990. And then, of course, you write about that as well. But this is only 30 years ago, and this is only a few years before Major League Soccer was created. And it seems right. like such a desolate island that it was, but it wasn't that long ago. Are young people surprised at this, do you think?
Yeah, very much so. I actually, as we speak today, I have a story coming out on the New Yorker's website tomorrow about this, sort of how far we've come in soccer's popularity and how easy it is to sort of forget what the old days were like. I mean, you look around now at the World Cup and I went to this viewing party this outdoor viewing party, you know, the huge screen, just the kind you see everywhere. And there's like families there, and it's just a slice of Americana, and everyone's in US jerseys. It's, as I was writing this book, it was totally disorienting, because this was during CONCACAF qualifiers, when the US was qualifying for the World Cup. And my mind is in 1989, when the US is playing before tiny crowds, and I'm watching games on TV. And I mean, you've seen all the new stadiums in Austin and Orlando and Memphis and here and there. And it's unbelievable. You look at that from where I was sitting writing this book, and you just think, we've done it. Like, we did it, we made it. Everything that all the people in soccer back in the late 80s, everything they wanted to happen came true, which is so cool. And that's kind of one thing I loved about making this book. And it didn't really occur to me until I'd finished this book. It's just like, you know, wow, there it is. You know, there's where we, I don't want to say where we started, but that's where we were at a certain point. And some people had some pretty grand ambitions, and here we are now.
Yeah.
So, to get back to your question, I don't think people have much idea at all. It's shocking how not only indifferent people were to soccer, but to how much it was hated. It was un-American. Mm-hmm. And thus, hating soccer was sort of the American thing to do.
I find that ironic in some sense, because so many of the characters in your story are first generation Americans.
Yes.
Are by Gansler, who came here as a young boy from Europe. And there's just so much of it is sort of says, this is who we are. This is who we've always been. And so I find that interesting that there's this, as you've mentioned a minute ago, this juxtaposition here of the game and who's in the game, and it says so much about who we are. I think the game of soccer, I think, says a lot about who we are.
Absolutely. And I'm glad you brought that up, because that's another thing. Just like, it's just such an American story, you know, that all of these guys grew up in households that, you know, these guys, they would call these sort of everyone else apple pie kids, you know, the homecoming king, queen, and cheerleaders and stuff. And these guys weren't like that. I mean, they kind of were, but you know, when they would go home, they were living in these households where everything revolved around soccer in the old country, and you know, the games and the clubs and the teams that their parents had grown up watching and left behind. And so for them to bring their own country, America, into the World Cup was really special, and almost, I mean, just emotionally overwhelming for them. It was the coolest thing they could have possibly done.
Yeah. The book is titled New Kids in the World Cup. And the totally late 80s and early 90s tale of the team that changed American soccer forever, published here in 2022 by the University of Nebraska Press. And while they are headquartered just a little ways down the road from where I'm at, I don't get anything for that, but I am proud of the fact that they published this book, and it's been fun to read, and it's been fun to relive some of this. Adam Elder is the author of this book. So did you know much of anything when you started, except for this video? Did you know much of anything about these people? Did you almost start from scratch?
Pretty much. You know, I remember, so I watched a tiny bit of the 1990 World Cup. I was in fifth grade, going into sixth grade. This is back when World Cups took place during the summer, you know. And you know, I remember reading about it in Sports Illustrated, seeing it on the Spanish channel, seeing it on TNT. And I remember Paul Caligiuri, because he's got a memorable name, even if it's hard to read. And that he scored a very important goal in a small country that I had never heard of, Trinidad and Tobago. But I didn't know, you know, I should back up. The 1994 World Cup came around, and I was like all in on soccer at that point. I've been looking forward to it. I absorbed the whole thing. And so I remember that whole team. Like I could probably rattle off the whole roster to this day. But and then, you know, at some point I remember hearing or learning that a few of those players had also reached the World Cup in 1990, but it didn't mean a lot to me. Again, there was just so little mention, so little discussed. There was just so little information about this 1990 team out there, as if it were this weird little like footnote in history that everyone, you know, wants to acknowledge was very important, but no one wants to really actually acknowledge or talk about. And so I was starting, I would say, mostly from scratch. I knew players' names, but I didn't know what they had gone through, where they had come from. Certainly not what the 1990 experience was like, which was so fascinating. I can't imagine another, you know, American team ever having that experience, just because they went through it for mostly the first time, not literally the first time, because we'd been as recently as 1950.
Way back.
But you know, they were, it's just like trying to get to the moon by now. No one remembers how to do it. You know, you got to figure it out all over again. And that's what these guys did. And, you know, there's a lot of sort of misadventures about that throughout the book. It was fun learning it all, to answer your question, because I went in not knowing a whole lot about it myself, aside from some names.
Were they all happy to talk about it, happy to relive this? Were you able to chase down most, if not all, of the players involved, the coaches?
Yes. And, you know, for a lot of them, it was their only crack at a World Cup. And so, but even for the ones who went to other World Cups, yeah, they all say this team was really special. This team had something about it. They played with chips on their shoulders. You know, the 94 team had a remit that, to make, you know, soccer popular and to reach the second round and whatever. But these guys were playing for the future of soccer in America. And they would have to go get real jobs if this thing didn't take off. And so there was a hunger about them. They were a bunch of young bucks, you know, young, arrogant, but also kind of like in the fight of their life, if you know what I mean. Yeah. And so there was a real edge to this team. And the fun thing was watching a bunch of old games. And I mean, this is a hardcore group of guys. I would never want to play them. I mean, they were rough. They were tough. They didn't back down from anyone or anything. Not even the Czechs, the Czechoslovakians, which was a very rough game in their, mm-hmm. in their first World Cup. But they didn't hang their heads. And so I got to say, I forgot what your question was.
Yeah, no, that's good. You answered it. One of the things that has changed is that the national team doesn't play at San Diego Soccer Park or El Camino College any longer. They play at big stadiums. But another thing that hasn't changed is how rugged it is to play a visiting game in CONCACAF in Trinidad, mm-hmm. or in El Salvador or in Honduras or other places that you've described. It is still a kind of a rough and tumble adventure surviving in some of the places that play in CONCACAF. And I thought you did a nice job of describing what that was like, because I think it's still kind of like that, but what it was like to try and survive just to get out of CONCACAF to get to the World Cup. And we should remind people there were only 24 slots. There's 32 now, and there's going to be 48 when they come around in 26, but there were only 24 places. There were only two teams from CONCACAF that made it. Kind of help us relive some of those places that you have to go through just to get out of CONCACAF and get to the World Cup.
It's incredible. I mean, as the trainer put it to me very succinctly, they just really, really, really don't want you to get much sleep there. They will police park outside your hotel room and run their sirens all night. People are lighting fireworks. They'll hire a band to play outside. They pull the fire alarm. You know, your phone rings and you just hear giggling when you pick it up. The air conditioning mysteriously stops working the night before a game. The bus driver shows up late to pick you up. Sometimes the bus can't even get to the stadium because fans block it so that you're forced to get out, and then they can throw bags of excrement at you, let's say, to put it politely. The stadium in El Salvador is really something else. The old stadium, I should say. There were holes in the visitors' locker room in the ceiling where fans could, let's just say, put whatever they want down that hole at you. And there wasn't even a toilet in it. It was a hole in the ground for the players to use. I mean, it was like stepping into hell in a way. The practice field isn't really a field. I mean, it's just, you can go on and on. And then in the game, you know, the referee is worried for his life. He's not interested in calling a fair match, probably. The fans are throwing batteries at you. They're throwing coins. They're throwing lighters. And like, and that's before, you know, the whistle even blows. I mean, and then you got to play 90 minutes of soccer against the home team at the hottest part of the day. And they're up for a fight. And, you know, by the way, no soccer team ever wants to lose to the United States. You know, to lose to the United States, who everyone knows doesn't take soccer seriously, especially back then, in their eyes. This is not my opinion. This is the world's opinion. To lose to the United States in soccer is just unthinkable. It's an embarrassment. And so my sense is, and people have told me in many conversations, you know, that everyone tries twice as hard against the United States for that reason. No, it's rough. And, you know, there was very little oversight back then in games to Central America. It's gotten better now, but not a lot. You know, they'll still do whatever it takes to put you off your game.
One of the threats or one of the suggestions in 1990 was that if the United States didn't qualify to go to Italy in the 90 World Cup, that the 1994 World Cup would be taken away from them. How serious was that threat or that notion or that fear that, because they had promised the U.S. basically, if they make the World Cup in 90, then they're going to host in 94. They made a promise that they'd start a domestic league, which they did. But was there a real, right. Was there something to the fact that they might not have hosted 94 if they hadn't made it in 90?
It depends on who you ask.
Yeah. You always get the straight poop from FIFA, I'm sure.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Sunil Gulati says no. There was a lot of back and forth about hosting. The players leading up to that decisive game in Trinidad against Trinidad said yes. They were all aware of it. It was some kind of rumor, some unconfirmed rumor. And so they played like there was going to be, you know, no soccer if they lost, no World Cup, nothing to play for. There was, long story short, there was a party, U.S. Soccer's AGM, right after the U.S. was awarded the World Cup, and all the big cheeses from FIFA were flown in, you know, including João Havelange, who was president at the time, Sepp Blatter was secretary general, and, you know, that was back, maybe it's still the case, but it's like, when they arrive, they're not even supposed to open a door or touch a door, so, like, everyone has to run ahead of them and, like, open a door for them and remove impediments. I mean, it's this, like, you know, sort of ridiculous sort of courtship that you have to play into. And anyway, observers from that night just thought something was kind of off, that maybe folks in U.S. soccer felt that the bid was conditional still, because it was very important that the U.S. qualify. FIFA didn't want to have egg on their face awarding the World Cup to a country who can't qualify on its own merits. They didn't want to look like they were just so crassly chasing the vast commercial potential that the United States promised them.
which not only promised, but delivered.
Yes, for sure.
Yeah. So, spoiler alert, I won't. We didn't win the World Cup in 1990 in Italy, by the way, for those who aren't really sure what happened, but I don't want to give too much of your story away. But did it matter really? I mean, you relive it and you retell it for us and you describe it, but the story that you're telling, did it matter what happened in the World Cup itself? Did that impact at all the richness of the story you're trying to tell?
I think so, because that to me was when they were actually put to the test. You know, it's one thing to say you got to the World Cup, but then, like, what do you actually deserve to belong there? How does this team of first timers on the up actually do at the World Cup? And, you know, that those three games they played at the World Cup are an incredible roller coaster themselves, where, you know, they got absolutely taught the worst lesson possible in their first game about what the World Cup and what the rest of the world is really about and how it treats soccer, to the point where they're questioning their futures as soccer players, leading into their second game, which was only against the hosts and two-time winners, Italy, in Rome, that everyone was predicting an absolute slaughter. And I mean, I don't need to go into it too much, but it was, the whole thing turned out pretty cool for them, mm-hmm. I would say. And I loved it. So it was a chance to bring American soccer to the world, I like to say, I guess, and show them that Americans actually do belong in the soccer world.
Yeah. I don't know if you considered this a risk. I don't think it was, but one of the things you did in here that I really admire is that you did an entire chapter on describing what happened in a soccer match and this qualifying soccer match. And I want to ask you how you did that. I'm sure you watched the video, but how you did that, but you relived dramatically this soccer match in Trinidad and Tobago, that is the moment, one of the great moments, right? But how did you do that? And how much of a task was that to get that feeling on paper of what you were watching?
I read a lot of those minute by minute reports. The Guardian does them so well. So I sort of had in mind how I wanted to present the action sort of in the moment, I guess. I just thought it would be weird to like tell a story and not sort of, you know, everything in soccer sort of happens on the field, I guess. That's where the results are. And so it would feel weird to me to like sort of skip over that part, I guess. Plus I like the game, and I love the drama and the tension of a soccer game. I just didn't think I couldn't not tell it. And so I was just sort of watching as a fan, I guess, and sort of, I should say, narrating it as a fan, mm-hmm. not quite as a commentator, but just sort of, as a narrator of a story, really. I don't know. I honestly didn't think about it too much. It just sort of felt right, I guess. And like I said a moment ago, almost like I couldn't afford not to in order to tell this story.
And you watched the video, you got a hold of the entire game. Did you get a hold of a better version than you might see on YouTube that is blurry and by 4x3 and not 16x9 version? Did you have
I got a worse version.
You got a worse, version.
Yeah. So here's a sad story. So a friend of Bob Lee's at ESPN, who works kind of in the vaults, was kind enough to send me all of this team's games in 88, 89, 90. I got the World Cup games from someone else because TNT broadcast it. But ESPN's version of the crucial Trinidad game is missing from their archives. It's been missing for years. No one knows what happened to it. So I had to obtain it another way. But anyway, yeah, I was watching the grainy videos and listening to, you know, JP Delacamera and Seamus Mallon, who are, you know, JP is still calling a game.
He is. Yeah.
In the World Cup. He's not everyone's cup of tea. But I love him because since the 80s, including for this book, and to me, he kind of sounds like American soccer to me. And I realize that means nothing to a lot of new fans, but I like it myself.
He's my cup of tea for two reasons, because he does sound like American soccer and he's a friend of mine. So
wonderful.
He's my cup of tea in a number of respects. And I really like
him. I think
him.
He's great.
Yeah.
Yeah, me too.
And the fact that in the early days he called himself Jean-Paul Delacamera and you referred right. to him as such. Now it's JP, but you referred to him as he referred to himself in those days. So,
right.
Yeah, that was cool. That was cool.
Thanks.
Ramos putting it in.
to Caligiuri. Beats the first man. A left-footed shot. Paul Caligiuri has scored a goal in the USA. Lead 1-0.
An amazing goal by Caligiuri, who made a great move to get by one player and then hit this rocket. Look at this good move. And then the left foot, just a super volley into that far corner.
There is no overtime. There are no penalty kicks in this round of World Cup qualifying. USA leads it 1-0. Cutting across. Trinidad playing it to the opposite side of the field. Stutter steps outside of the area now. Jameson's shot was wide of Tony Miola. What were those gestures about? A trip from the USA, some sponsors, some friends, some parents. And they'll be noisy if the USA will hang on and win this. Here comes a run for the ball with Lewis. Off a shot, it was deflected wide in the do-or-die situation. Right side of the field, Jamerson's pass. Oh, the USA let that one get through into the area, and it was just deflected wide. Brian Bliss with it. Oh, just when you think it was safe to come out of the water. Time running out, precious seconds left. The USA on a Paul Caligiuri goal from Tab Ramos at the 31st minute are trying to hold on and go to Italy, and they do! The USA has realized a dream. They will qualify for the World Cup in 1990.
Writing a book is not easy, and you said you really had to grind it in the last year or so, and it's hard. I should know this, but is this the first book you've written?
It is. I'd never written a book before. I was just doing mostly feature stories, web stories, newspaper articles, things like that.
Is it what you had hoped? Is the experience what you had hoped, or did you have an expectation of what the experience would be like?
I have a good writing friend here named Mike Sager, who's kind of one of those legends in narrative feature magazine journalism. And he's written a few books, and he prepared me for the worst, just talking about how slowly the book industry moves. So I was prepared for the worst, I guess. And it wasn't like that. It was a lot more, it was a lot easier, I think, than magazine writing. The editing was a little less intense, and I was just kind of left to my own devices a little more. But it's one of those things where, you know, you finish writing it, but that's where things sort of just get started. Then you got to figure out a title, figure out the cover image, you know, get the photos, and then, you know, of course, there's the copy editing, the fact checking, and all that sort of stuff. So, yeah. And then the marketing, which is exhausting, marketing a book. But when it's something, and I just love this story, and I never get tired of talking about it. So, you know, a lot of people told me I'll get sick of talking about the book, but I never will. I just love this story, and I love this team, and I don't know, just it's I love doing it.
And did you hear back from the players and the people involved? And I mean, I recognize a lot of the names, and I know some of them. Did you hear back from them and their response?
Yes, I have. My favorite of which is the trainer, Rich Reel. He was there the whole time. And you know how it is, like oftentimes the guy behind the guy is like the one who has great perspective on everything. Because the players, you know, the players are there, but they're sort of in the middle of it. And they have like one job to do. Rich emailed me right ahead of the Iran game last week and said that his son had emailed him talking about the biggest U.S. game in history. And he said, that's not the biggest U.S. game. And he said, guess what my son's getting for Christmas?
Yes.
There you go. Exactly.
There you go.
So anyway, yeah, it's and it means a lot to them. And, you know, you hear about people who are friends of this player and that player, and they're excited to sort of hear the story for themselves. So, yeah, it's been nice. It's been great. But I guess the best part for me is just meeting like random American soccer fans out on a book tour, you know, people who just they're fans of the American team, and they just wanted to come out and, you know, buy the book and hear me talk about it and learn more about it. I don't know. It's a really special thing, you know, when you work on something for a while, so long by yourself. You know, I love to say that, you know, for years you work on this thing, and, you know, being a writer, people say, oh, what are you working on? And you start telling them, and, you know, within like 3 seconds, you see their eyes sort of start to glaze over. And so you just get used to this idea that, well, you know, I'm kind of writing it for me, and, you know, maybe one day other people will care, sort of thing. And so when it finally comes out, and when people finally, you know, it's amazing what a cover of a book can do to generate excitement. So once people see the cover and see that it's a real thing, and they want to come out and they want to learn more about it, it's the coolest feeling in the world when you've been like sitting with this sort of thing in your head for many years.
Are you going to write another book? Is this a process that you would like to do again? Find a story?
I would.
Yeah.
I loved it. It's fun really drilling down on one thing and just totally getting inside of a story. The only thing is like, I just, you know, I fell really hard for this team and the story and everything. And it's hard to imagine caring as much about something else. I mean, I probably will. I just don't know what it is now. Yeah, it was just, I don't know. I love soccer so much. It was just a really fun, it just felt important to do this, you know? And, mm-hmm. and the way I approached it and stuff, I felt like no one else was going to approach it in this way. And I was really confident about it, sort of combining a little bit of pop culture in it. And I don't know, it just made sense to me from the start. And so I just got really attached to it. And so if I found something else like that, then yeah, I'd totally be up for doing it again. But I will say, writing a book just takes a lot of time and a lot of resources and just this kind of leap of faith. Cause you know, the advance may or may not be big, and it's like in for a penny, in for a pound, you know. If you're gonna do it, you just do your best, and you know, you just gotta trust it'll like pay off later.
Yeah.
In all sorts of ways.
Yeah, there you go. So when this adventure started, you didn't have an agent? Did you basically sell yourself to the publisher yourself, or did you have an agent by then?
When I started, I was talking with my friend, the one I mentioned a moment ago, Mike Sager. Mm-hmm. He's the kind of guy who knows people, and he was sort of acting as an agent. And then he introduced me to, long story short, to a literary agent in New York City who is a soccer fan and happens to know the folks at publishers who like soccer, the editors. And so it went from there.
Were you surprised? I hope you're not offended if I suggest I'm surprised this story hadn't been told before, that the importance of this being the totally late 80s and early 90s team that changed American soccer forever, right? That the story had not been told. Had you thought about that?
Oh, all the time. I could not believe that this, I just felt like it fell in my lap. Like this thing was all mine. For years, I thought that. I couldn't believe it. How had no one told this story? So 2 points on that. Number one, others had tried. I learned along the way talking to sources that this guy and that guy had tried to do it. And I'm not sure what happened. I can only assume it was lack of interest, because that's the other thing. You know, as much as we talk about the progress that soccer has made in this country in terms of its popularity, you know, you still run into just the gatekeepers in the mainstream media who just still aren't aboard yet. They still don't get it. And there's still a lot of resistance to soccer. Like it's still around. And so it's just, you know, going back to like the 70s when the NASL was really popular, you know, if you weren't in an NASL market, you probably didn't hear about it, because most sports writers and their sports editor, who's even older than they are, didn't get it, didn't know about it, didn't want anything to do with it. And I just think those attitudes still persist in this country. So there is a reason the story has not been told before, I guess. Yeah. So to your point, though, you know, that's what made me feel, once I got a deal, even just like so honored and fortunate, I guess, to be able to write about it.
As it turns out, are you happy that then this book came out when the U.S. was actually in a World Cup, that it comes out in 2022, that we're talking about soccer and you can get it for Christmas while the World Cup's still going on and all of those things? Did it turn out to be timing better for you, even though it might have been disappointing that you couldn't do it 4 years ago?
Yes. And also, if I would have done it 4 years ago, it would have been terrible. I wouldn't have had enough time. I didn't know the story well enough. And also, I just think I'm a better writer. You know, I mean, it's just one of those things. The more you do it, the better at it you are. And I feel like I've gotten a lot better in the last 4 years than if I would have attempted it back then. So, I was fortunate in many ways for that, for sure.
Are you a pleasurable writer or are you a tortured writer? Because I know both. People who are good writers and it's like, and then others that say, I can't wait to sit down at the keyboard and do my thing.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Probably a little bit of both. It tortures me when I'm not writing. But then again, you know, every story is different. You know, some of them are easy and some of them really aren't. And so some of them flow and some of them you just have to like wrestle with and, you know, like cage fight with almost. It's hard to say. It just depends on the story, huh?
Yeah. So in the end here now, through all of this process, what's the most fun part about writing and publishing a book?
The funnest part with any writing is it's like when you find a story that you really like, it's like a dog with a bone. You just want to keep chewing on it like all day long. You know, I would joke to my wife that, you know, I was like physically there when I was writing the book, but like in my mind was like back in 1989 and 1990, you know. It was just such a fun place to spend time, sort of recreating what I lived through and which was like honestly a very cool time in my life in many ways that I don't need to get into. The other thing I would say is, after all the work it takes to produce a book, and the exhausting marketing and fretting about, is anyone going to come out to my book events and am I inviting the right people and why don't I get more, you know, Twitter followers and just, you know, all this kind of anxiety that you feel. What's been really interesting is, you know, I've been a writer for a while, like about 20 years. And I started in community newspapers, you know, kind of like the very roots of journalism. And I've been fortunate enough to write for like some, you know, good publications, these sort of like career goals. But writing a book opens a lot of doors career-wise. And I don't mean to sound like some social climber or whatever, but it's cool to be able to just like meet people and work with people and just have people excited about something you've done. I guess what I appreciate is that writing a book's a really big deal to a lot of people, like even bigger than it is to yourself, I think. And so that's been like really amazing, is to just see, sort of going back to what I said earlier about how it's amazing to sort of see people get excited about this thing that only you were excited about for quite a while. It's humbling and gratifying and all that to see how other people react to this thing you created.
Yeah. It sounds like you're proud of this work.
Can you tell?
Yeah, no, it does.
I am. It's taken a lot. It's just been cool. I mean, it's been my life, especially for the past few months as this thing is been released and the World Cup's happening as we speak, and and all of that. It's taken up a lot of my attention. It's been awesome.
Can you imagine what these people that you wrote about in 1989, 1990, will look ahead and say, hey, in 2026, this thing is going to be maybe the grandest, most expensive, the most watched, crazy spectacle that American sport could ever put on. Could you imagine that they could think that far ahead and see what it's going to be like?
Absolutely not. No, there's no way. I can't even imagine it myself.
What you need to do is time your next book so it comes out right before the next World Cup, and then sell some books before all the rest of the world comes here. There you go.
I've been considering that myself.
There you go.
Yeah.
Well, thanks very much for writing the book. Thanks for sharing this story with us. We appreciate it, and thanks for giving us some of your time to talk about it.
Oh, it's been an honor. Thanks for asking so many questions. It's super fun to talk about, and it's great to talk about this stuff with a fellow fan.
So what you need is all these books behind. You see people get interviewed with books, and they've got like 12 copies of their book behind you. See, when you go on the big networks, that's what you've got to do. But in lieu of that, this is what I'll do is I'll show this here for those who are going to see this on video. It is New Kids in the World Cup. The totally late 80s and early 90s tale of the team that changed American soccer forever. The author is Adam Elder, and thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. And I will say, my friends down the road, it is published by the University of Nebraska Press. In 2022, the U.S. qualified for the knockout round in Qatar, but then lost to the Netherlands. It's the next World Cup that may be the most important in history. The U.S., Canada, and Mexico host a 48-team tournament in 2026. And we'll be here to talk about it. Thanks again to Adam Elder, the author of New Kids in the World Cup, the total late 80s and early 90s tale of the team that changed American soccer forever. I'm John Schrader. This is Watch the Media.
Dedication, heart and soul. You have the tools to achieve your goals. In a battle, I never lose cause I'm a champion. I march on till victory is won. Reaching higher, striving harder. Always doing better cause it's a part of the winning spirit. You gotta keep your chin up and we'll be coming home with the World Cup. So put your best foot forward, together let's step. But make sure momentum is kept. Togetherness and unity means victory for you and me. With intellect and self-respect, attain whatever you want to get. Togetherness and unity means victory in Italy. With dedication, heart and soul, you have the tools to achieve your goals.
When I was young, my folks would demand, work hard for what you want and be the best you can. Stay out of trouble, get an education. If you do, you gain admiration. Respect yourself as well as others. Love your sisters and love your brothers. Stay off drugs, keep your mind clear, so you can see when victory is near.
Togetherness and unity means victory for you and me. With intellect and self-respect, attain whatever you want to get. Togetherness and unity means victory in Italy. With dedication, heart and soul, you have the tools to achieve your goal.
For the first time in 40 years we're here. The object is clear and victory is near. Yeah, it's in the air. Can't you tell? And it's such a sweet, sweet smell. The USA, we're going all the way. We didn't come to fool around. We're here to play. So let's get busy and let's work together. Good results for a strong endeavor. It took us one score, plus one more. Now the US is knocking at the door. It took us a while, but we're here, so what's up? We plan to go home with the World Cup. We practice hard, made our bodies work and jerk. Now we're ready to go berserk. So if you're looking, you know where to find me. I'm picking up my cup at the Italian 90. Kicking the ball against the wall of the mall. Ever since I was small,
I had dreams of being on a team, and now that I'm here, you know it doesn't seem like...